to the Beyond Writing Podcast, brought to you by Bright Little Light Press. I'm your host, Dacri Carey, and today we have guest host Kay Rhodes with us.
Hello.
Today we're going to talk about some common misconceptions and misinformation about publishing and self-publishing. And let me give you fair warning again, I am ill again. I have a sinus infection, so I may sniffle and I probably sound funny. I'll try to edit out as many of the sniffles as possible during editing. But bear with me today. All right, so The Guardian recently posted an article about how self-published authors were making their way into Hollywood, which is great news for self-publishers because the idea of a Hollywood film being made from a self-publisher's book would have been unheard of a few years ago. So it's really good news, and this article specifically was focusing on Mark Dawson, who is a very successful self-publisher. And you can get more information about him online. I'll also post a link to the Guardian article in the show notes. But the comments of the article were a very interesting cross-section of people spreading a lot of misinformation about publishing and self-publishing. And I know in general you're supposed to not feed the trolls, but this seemed like a good teachable moment because a lot of these opinions that people were expressing seem to be common misconceptions or misinformation that I've seen all over the internet. So I thought it might be useful to you guys to talk about some of those points and explore them in more detail. And Kay is here today because Kay is not as familiar with the publishing process or self-publishing or any of these aspects. So I think his opinion may be more representative of the everyman's view, although I think he's probably somewhere in between some of these posters and someone who's really knowledgeable about the process. But he's here to basically be our talking mouthpiece again.
And I also have not read the comments.
And also to give me breaks intermittently while I sniffle and drink water and all the stuff that sick people need to do. So I'm just going to dive right in and I'm going to read some of the comments and tell you why they're wrong or what's wrong about them. And again, not trying to feed the trolls, trying to ignore things that are just dumb and off base and bitter, but I really want to correct some common misconceptions. So the first comment I want to address says, 23 books in 4 years surely raises questions about quality. And then there's some stuff I'm omitting. It goes on to say, and surely further discussion is warranted from the bestseller point of view. If a self-published author is at the top of the charts because they've sold their work for pennies or for free, again, that simply says people like free stuff. So we're going to address these comments in two parts. First, we're going to talk to the part where this person commented on 23 books in 4 years raises questions about quality. So one of the things that Mark Dawson is known for is publishing prolifically. And I think that's been a big part of his key to success as a self-published author. A number of other self-published authors that are doing really well publish a lot of books every year. Well, what we would consider a lot. And I will draw your attention to one of the earlier podcasts, which we talked about how long does it take to publish a book. So the idea of publishing 23 books in 4 years may seem a little counterintuitive to some of the stuff I was telling you a few episodes ago about how long it takes to publish a book. That was more about the traditional publication process and all of the things that go into publishing. It's certainly possible to publish multiple books a year, especially if you have a lot of projects in progress. So you can write a book and then go on to start writing the next book while the first book is in editing. You could be 6 books down the road by the time a book makes it into revisions or you get into the book launch process. So the process of writing the next book doesn't have to wait until the entire process is done.
Something that I've seen a few authors do is they'll have multiple series going and they'll be putting out multiple books a year, but they are in alternating between 2 to 3 series. And I can't help but wonder if that's partially because of the publisher's choices and that they may, you know, I don't know if it's for a fact or anything, but I wonder if maybe they're not just going, hey, we don't want to push too much of X in too short of a time, but we can push different things.
So obviously Kay did not listen to the podcast where we talked about how publishers decide which books to publish. But one of the things we talked about in that podcast, how do publishers decide which books to buy? We talked about how publishers often have a certain allotment of a specific type of book in a publishing season, be it a month or a quarter or a year. And it may be that they're trying to publish multiple fantasy books in a year. And one author, they don't want to publish all their fantasy books by one author. They want to diversify a little in case that one author doesn't do well or one of the books doesn't sell well. So they're not putting all their eggs in one basket. So they're spreading it, their allotment of genre X across multiple authors. There are a lot of reasons why a publisher might not want to publish too many of a specific type of book or books by a specific author at a time.
But I have to say, like with one of the self-publishing authors I've been following who put out a ton of books in a series, it's been spectacular to just like be able to devour book after book after book in the series that I'm enjoying.
And that sort of speaks to what I'm calling the Netflix culture, where we've gotten a little bit spoiled by the ability to binge consume content, whether it's a great Netflix series that we're enjoying or a self-published author who's producing lots of books per year. Because we've become sort of accustomed to that as a society, being able to do that definitely is a selling point. And I know I've heard from readers and spoken to readers who, when they're deciding whether or not to give an author a try, will actually look and see how many books that author has published, because they don't really want to read an author that only has one or two books. They want to know, if I like this author, can I go read like six or eight books right now?
I'll also hold off frequently until there's a lot more in a series, because it's like, hey, people say the series is great, but it's only two books in and the last one isn't there. I'm like, I don't want to read it and go, oh, crap, there isn't the last one. I'm just going to, no, I'll wait until it's out, you know. But if there's 20 books in the series, like, I don't care if it's done or not. I'll start in.
That's a good point. So to speak to the question of quality, I also wanted to bring up, this isn't something that's just specific to self-published authors. There are a lot of traditionally published authors that are well known for being prolific. So I just picked a few of the biggest names. There is James Patterson, who has published around 150 novels since 1976, but a lot of those have actually been since 1996. And to give you an example of how many books he publishes in a short period of time, in 2009 he signed a deal to write 18 books between 2009 and 2012. So that works out to 6 books a year. And some people argue that James Patterson doesn't count because he uses a co-author for a lot of his books, or in other people's minds, he doesn't write them at all. He just puts his name on them. He's really a branding empire. Whether or not that's true is sort of beside the point. He also holds a Guinness Book of World Records for the most bestsellers. So the fact that he's been able to produce such a massive quantity hasn't prevented him from also producing things that sell really well.
People wouldn't keep buying them if they were crap.
Some of the other commenters on this thread may disagree with you, but we'll get those comments later. Another author who's well-known for being prolific is Stephen King. So he's written around 50 novels since 1967, but Stephen King has written over 200 short stories. So if you take all of that writing into account, he is a very prolific author too. And I think very few people would argue about the quality of Stephen King's writing. Another author who has a massive publishing empire is a romance author, Nora Roberts. She's written more than 200 romance novels since 1981. Her books have spent a combined total of more than 860 weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list. That's a lot of weeks as a bestseller. You don't get to that point if the books you write are crap. Another romance author, Susan Mallory, has written over 80 romances since the mid-1990s. So all of these traditionally published authors are producing anywhere from 3.5 to 5 books a year, and we don't consider any of them to be crap. So the perception that 23 books in 4 years, which works out to just under 6 books per year, must mean that the quality is compromised, is a false perception. If you do the math, that translates to less than 2,000 words per day. And Mark has spoken about this himself and said that he averages between 2,000 and 3,000 words Monday through Friday. So he doesn't work on the weekends, and he says he often will do that in the morning, and then in the afternoon he'll work on editing or some of the other publishing business work that he has to do. The other reason that Mark is such a successful author is that he's really good at marketing his books, which is another piece entirely. There are plenty of self-published authors who just aren't able to do the marketing piece very well, so you've probably never heard of them, but may also be equally prolific, and the quality may be fine.
But to back that up, like with NaNoWriMo, you've got completely unskilled people churning out, what is it, about
1667 words per day.
Right. People with no professional writing skill who haven't been doing this for years, many of them, this is the first time they've ever attempted it, are able to churn out 1,600 words a day. Someone who does this as their full-time job, as a living, like, you get better with this with practice. You're going to put out more words, and they're going to be better.
So, to use myself as an example, I've been writing for over 10 years, and I can write 2,000 words, depending on the topic, sometimes in under an hour, other times in anywhere from 1 to 4 hours. It depends on whether or not I have to do a lot of research on the topic, or whether or not I pause to think often, but honestly, 2,000 words is really not that much. And some of the best-known authors have spoken about having like 6,000 to 10,000 word days where they just churn out words. So there's a false equation between length of time of writing and the quality of the work.
And also people are probably comparing themselves to that, like, how many words do I put out? Like, if they think about it at all, they're going to use themselves as a basis of comparison. And, like, unskilled amateur people cannot assume that the equation works out equally for them versus someone like Stephen King.
So there seem to be a number of these comments related to the length of time it takes to produce these works. So I'm going to skip ahead to some of those other comments, and then we'll come back and address the other half of that specific comment. So one of the things I also wanted to draw attention to is the fact that quality is subjective. So these people who are saying that the idea that these people who are producing this massive word count can't possibly be producing quality books, what is your idea of quality? If your idea of quality is, like, literary novels that are really thought-provoking and analytical, maybe that's true. Maybe you can't spend as much time as it takes to produce these really thought-provoking works. But those are not the works that are most often commercially successful. So there are plenty of books that are good enough for people to enjoy reading them and sell really well. So you as an author, what do you want to get out of your writing career? Do you want to be known for producing these very analytical, thought-provoking literary works, in which case you may only do one or even a handful throughout your entire life, and you probably will never make a living doing it? Or do you want to tell stories for a living and enjoy commercial success, in which case you're probably going to be producing at a higher quantity, but that doesn't necessarily mean that your stuff is bad, just it may not be as thought-provoking as some literary works that people keep bringing up in this particular thread. So I would argue in this specific case, these examples that I brought up are like mystery and thriller and romance writers, and these are genres that are well known for having really voracious readers. People who read in these genres often read a lot of books. They consume books at a high rate. So there's a demand for quantity in these genres. So I would argue that these books by these best-selling authors are as good as they need to be to appeal to people in those genres.
Obviously, by virtue of the fact that they're best-selling books.
Yeah, and another commenter said something like, this is capitalism in its purest form because the market is deciding how much these works are worth. And if a lot of people want them, then obviously the market supports the fact that these are good enough works. So I think the argument about quality that continues to come up in this thread, and I think is sort of a pervasive question around self-published authors, is basically just people with a snobbish attitude. They have this misconception that because you're self-published, you couldn't get published traditionally, or that your work hasn't passed certain gatekeepers, and therefore is not quality, or especially, again, if you're prolific, like Mark Dawson, people think you can't possibly be producing good stuff because there's way too much of it coming out. And Mark himself says that what he writes is not high art, and that he writes to appeal to an audience, and he writes to tell good stories, and his audience seems to enjoy his work, so he's satisfied with that. So for you as an author, you need to decide if that is enough to satisfy you, or if you really want to aspire to this higher level of literary work that, again, may not achieve commercial success for you, but if that's what you want, then go for it. So another person made a comment, it's a question of length. A conventionally published book is typically 70,000 or more words. If he's writing to a formula and in a genre, he could easily churn out 5 short books in a year. So the implication here is that a traditional book is 70,000 words or longer, and that Mark's books, because he writes so many of them so quickly, must be shorter than that. Again, that's not true. The math doesn't support it. It's just someone's perception. And the idea of writing to a formula or writing in a genre, the idea of that affecting quality, or the fact that if you are producing at a high volume, you must be writing to a formula, I call bullshit on that. That is not true. There are plenty of people who have great ideas and they're just able to keep writing or have the discipline to keep writing. This idea that, you know, oh, I have to stop and think about it, or oh, I'm going to get writer's block and have to work through it and really struggle to get this book out, that's typically a misconception that is fostered by frustrated novelists.
I think writers are, there's a high overlap in how fiction writers work with how programmers work. Like, they're, once you get into a state of flow, and I mean that in the psychological terms, like, once you get into that state, you can just keep going and produce massive quantities of good stuff, you know, for 6-8 hours at a stretch if you're really into it, and without thinking, you're just producing.
So to use myself as an example again, I have produced novels more than once that are in the 70 to 100,000 word range in approximately 4 to 6 weeks. So it is totally achievable. I am by no means a best-selling author, novelist, whatever, and I am fully capable of doing that because I've been writing professionally for 10 years. So I just have practice and have certainly, I think, gotten faster. But it's not uncommon. And a lot of mid-list authors or authors who do this for a living can write at that pace. It's just something that you develop as a skill like any other skill over time. And I will say, though, that achieving at that word count over such a short duration is really difficult to sustain for long term. So a lot of the authors I know who are really prolific, they are extremely prolific for a very short period of time. And then they get creatively burned out, or the other parts of their life that have had to sort of take a back seat while they have been so prolific resurface, and they may step away from writing entirely for a while, or they may cut back dramatically on their word count. And that also doesn't really factor in all of the business of publishing that needs to happen while you're doing this. If you're self-publishing, marketing and dealing with the infrastructure, you know, cover design, editing, all the pieces that go into it. So realistically, producing 70,000 to 100,000 word novels in a really short time span, repeatedly, isn't going to last very long. But, conversely, the idea that it takes years to drag out 70 to 100,000 words, like word by word, it's a struggle, you're birthing this massive thing, that is a misconception. Some authors work that way, not all. And again, another thing to know is every author is different. Every author's process is different, and what they do to create these works and what their output is, everyone has their own way of doing it. So it's really unfair to generalize, but a lot of people who are not successful authors have these conceptions in their head that just aren't accurate. So another comment sort of refuting this idea that it takes a long time to write a book: please don't make the all too common mistake of thinking that the longer it takes to write a book, the better the quality. This is just nonsense perpetuated by litfic writers who have to justify only producing one book every 2 or 3 years. How long a book takes to write is entirely dependent on the book and the writer, period. Some people write fast, some write slow. Some genres are simpler, some are more complex. None of that speaks to quality. You can spend 5 years writing a piece of garbage, or 5 weeks writing a masterpiece. It just depends, and any writer worth their salt recognizes that and respects the difference in process that we all have. So I couldn't agree more with that. It goes back to what I was just saying, like, everybody is different, everybody has their own pace, and even every work may differ. There are definitely some works I have done that have taken longer, and I've had to walk away from even in some cases and come back to them months or years later to finish them. And I know I'm not alone in that. I know, I forget how long exactly, but Patrick Rothfuss, Name of the Wind, hugely successful, took him over a decade to finish that book to his satisfaction. So it really varies depending on the work and the author. So to touch a little bit on that comment about litfic, there are some other comments further down, and this one speaks to that a little bit. I guess the difference between literary fiction and genre fiction is that literary fiction should say new things about the human condition, psychology, society, etc., whereas genre fiction is more about telling a story. There's obviously a place for both, and a market for both, but none of the writers I admire write books that quickly. Going back to what I was just saying, again, it depends dramatically on the work and the writer as to how long it takes to produce books. And this particular commenter I have discovered over the thread of this comments on this article. This particular commenter is a bit of a snob, so I'm just going to get that away up front. And I would say he's probably a troll, and I wouldn't waste any more time, except the idea that there is this difference between literary fiction and genre fiction. And I want to unpack that a little bit. There is this implication in that comment that literary fiction is better than genre fiction for some quality of better.
Yeah, I was going to say it's higher quality.
Yeah, I mean, if you are a person who writes literary fiction or appreciates literary fiction, I don't mean to wrap you into this blanket statement, but for the most part, people who are in love with the idea of literary fiction are snobs. They think it raises them to some elite level to appreciate literary fiction and to not be able to appreciate genre fiction or good storytelling or all the things that literary fiction people look down their noses at. It's just snobbery. It's just a form of intellectual elitism. There's nothing wrong with appreciating a good story or commercially popular authors. And as an author, if what you produce is commercial instead of literary, you should not feel bad. There is a place for it. It makes people happy. They enjoy reading it. It provides a form of escapism. It lets them understand other people's lives and empathize with other people. There are so many good things about it, you really shouldn't feel bad if you're producing commercial fiction. More objectively, to unpack that idea of better, this goes back to what you as an author want out of your writing career. You are the only person who can decide what you want. You're the only person who can decide how you want your work to be perceived, what level of time and energy you want to put into each piece of work, and really what your goals are as an author. So if the idea of you as an author is, I am going to be a literary fiction author, I really want to write these thought-provoking, analytical things, I want to be renowned for this, then go for it. Don't feel like that's not something you can aspire to, or that because it's not likely to be commercially successful, you should turn your back on it. If that's what you want to do, do it. On the flip side, if you don't care so much about, and I don't mean to denigrate people when I say this, the navel-gazing that is literary fiction, then you shouldn't feel bad about wanting to be commercially successful or make your career writing stories.
I, for one, am very thankful for authors who produce good, fun reads.
And to go back to this idea that literary fiction may not be commercially successful, look at the bestseller lists. If you look at any bestseller list, New York Times, Amazon, USA Today, very few of the books that are on the bestseller list are literary fiction. They're almost all commercial genre fiction. There are a variety of things that that speaks to, and I don't think I can really authoritatively speak on the process or on that right now without coming off sounding snobbish or sounding like I'm talking down about society, especially considering what's going on politically right now. So I'm just going to avoid this whole topic right now. But I will say that commercially successful books are often more mainstream genre fiction. And again, do the exercise for yourself. Go look at the bestseller lists. You'll see what I mean. Okay, I'm going to take a step back now and get off this idea that producing a high quantity of work is automatically a bad thing, or getting out of this difference between literary fiction and genre fiction and commercial success, and go back to this original comment that I started with at the beginning of the podcast. The second part of that comment was, and surely further discussion is warranted from the bestseller point of view, if a self-published author is at the top of the charts because they've sold their work for pennies or for free. Again, that simply says people like free stuff. So going back to the author from the article, Mark Dawson, he prices his works consistent with a small publisher. So his Kindle books are around $4.99, although he is in the UK, so it's pounds, and it may translate slightly differently to US dollars if you're listening from the US.
It's about $1.3 right now.
Yeah. Boy, I didn't think about how the conversion rate is really hurting UK authors right now. $9.99 for paperbacks. So that's pretty standard if you're a small press or a self-published author. It's sort of at the high end for self-publishing. But a lot of self-published authors do publish for free or a dollar their stories. I would say that's going to be the subject of a different podcast, how you price your work. There are certainly some cons to doing it this way, but in general, the author who is featured in this article doesn't do that. He prices at a reasonable rate based on a small publisher. Mark does offer some of his work for free in order to get people to sign up for his mailing list, which is a commonly accepted practice. Some people offer a book or two of the beginning of their series for free, especially if they've got a really long series arc, because the sell-through that you will get to the rest of those books more than makes up for getting rid of the first sale or two, just to get people into that world. Other authors who have shorter series may give away a novella, maybe a prequel novella, or another story with the same characters set in the same world, just to get people into the idea of that world. And honestly, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think the idea that traditional publishers won't do that because they don't need to do that is sort of snobbery. I think traditional publishers have been able to get away with not doing that because they were the gatekeepers of how people get out into the world. But now there are so many other options for people, and people are really interested in discovering more about the work before they make a purchasing decision. In part, one can argue because there's a lot more crap out there too, along with more good stuff. So I don't think it's bad for authors to offer discounts on their books. However, in this case, Mark did not. And there are a lot of indie publishers self-publishing their own work and making it onto the bestseller list, and most of them are not doing it by offering free giveaways. So the idea that you can only make it onto a bestseller list if you're selling your books for free is, again, bullshit. It is a common misconception about self-publishing and indie publishing. And the truth is, while traditional publishers have historically dominated sales, that is shifting and has shifted in the past few years and will continue to shift more in the past few years. Traditional sellers are still getting more in terms of the total piece of the pie, but self-publishers are eating away at market share amazingly. And there are a number of ways an author, an indie or self-published author, can achieve a bestseller status without giving away books. Usually it's done through years of building a career, establishing mailing lists and social media presence so that you have these venues to promote your work, lining up good promotions and publicity around the time of a book's launch. There are a lot of things people can do to get onto a bestseller's list, and that is typically a years-long process. So this isn't something that's happening overnight. It's not something that's happening because people are giving away their stuff for free. It's because these people are working at making a career out of self-publishing, and they're doing it successfully. So another comment that speaks to a lack of understanding of the publishing industry. Someone said, "I think everyone understands that a new author is unable to get a publishing deal unless that work can sell in the six figures. Agents understand this and won't take any new work, and why should they? Agents already have a stable of reliable six-figure authors. This means that the industry is closed to all new authors without name recognition, vast social network resources, or connections."
That is just so crazy.
There's more. "The future is exactly as stated. Many derivative works from a narrow selection."
But if you already had six-figure authors, why would they be doing derivative works? Because they're already doing their own things.
So the argument was that, specifically in this instance, Mark's books were derivative. And this particular commenter said something like Mark had ripped off some other series, partially verbatim, which I don't think is true. Like, the commenter said that Mark lifted part of the character's name and the entire idea behind the series, and that nobody is producing original work anymore. And partially this was a commentary on Hollywood and the fact that they're making all these comic book movies and stuff, which are not original material. They're based on comic books that have been selling successfully, and there's a degree of truth in that, and they're in that investors want to make movies that are going to make the money, just like publishers. Something we've talked about over and over again on the Beyond Writing podcast. Publishers aren't here to do a service for people. They exist to make money. So they want to publish things that they think are going to be commercially successful. The idea of publishing or a derivative work, in this case, a movie that's based on a book, but also books that are based on other books that are successful, is that we know this premise is successful. It has a proven audience. We can point to the number of sales it has and the amount of money it's likely to make. Therefore, that makes it less risky, and we're going to publish it.
But it's also a claim that anyone can make about any book and any movie because all of them are derivative of something. And the argument, like, there's what the all the various the nine classic archetypes or the seven classic and like different ways of counting. Like I've seen different ways of like even three. I think I've seen, and it's like they're all derivative. Like so many stories that are out there, which are wonderful, wonderful stories, are like well. If you simplify it down a lot, it's exactly the same as this other story. Yeah, but it's still a new story in its own way, and they have their own details. So I totally don't buy the argument of, you know, derivative works. Yes, technically there are some out there which are like just blatant ripoffs of other things. But overall, most of the things people call derivative are like, yeah, just like every other story on the planet for the past 1,000 years.
So what Kay is talking about with the seven or nine stories is the idea that literary professionals put out that there are seven archetypical story types, and if you strip away all of the details, every story that anybody can tell comes down to one of these story types. And these story types are very broadly things like man against society, man against God, man and woman. So they boil down to these very broad strokes that every story falls into. And there's definitely truth there.
Yeah. And you can even get more detailed than those archetypes and, you know, like, oh, this happens and then there's a dramatic climax and like, you know, the three-act play. It's like, yeah, you know what? Most of them are three-act plays and most of them have the climactic arc at the same point and most of them have, you know, this just four steps before it. And it's like, well, yeah, because this is how storytelling works and how it's evolved.
Exactly. There's sort of a natural cadence to us as a human species to the stories that we tell. And you can trace this back into oral tradition thousands of years ago before there were written stories. Stories have arcs. It's just sort of the way our brains work. We're working, we're programmed to sort of put things in a specific order and to have a specific amount of each thing. So if the beginning were really, really long and then all of a sudden it just ended, that would not be satisfying to us. We want there to be a beginning and a middle and end. And, you know, I don't want to get too much into the whole writing process, but as human storytellers, there's a natural rhythm to what we do. Going back to another thing that Kay sort of glossed right by, this idea that a publishing deal requires work that can sell in the six figures. That is bullshit. We have spoken on the podcast before about the decisions that go into whether or not a publisher chooses to buy a book. And sure, six-figure sales are great, and that means it's a much lower risk if they are projecting a six-figure sales. But most publishers only have a handful of authors that are producing six-figure sales. The bread and butter is these reliable mid-list authors who produce a modest but, again, reliable amount of income. So you have maybe a mid-list author that a publisher knows is going to bring in $50,000 on every book, and maybe that's not sexy like a six-figure deal, but it keeps the lights on. So there's room for other things in the publishing industry. There's also, again, the thing we spoke to about how publishers may invest in the long-term success of a writer when they hire on a writer. So they may think that, okay, book one may not sell that much. It's certainly not going to be a six-figure thing unless you're some crazy person, like a celebrity or something. But maybe over a series arc, a second and third book, you're going to build more audience, build more interest in the series, and therefore more sales, and then also drive backlist sales. So while it may not produce six figures within 3 to 6 months of launching, over the long term, it may be a worthwhile deal for a publisher. There's also the idea that agents won't take authors who won't produce six-figure deals is also bullshit. There are plenty of agents who are dealing with your mid-list authors. These aren't the sexy authors who produce these crazy big deals, but they're good bread and butter for agents to be able to have this reliable person who's going to produce 3 books a year, and each book is going to net roughly this much, and it's like clockwork.
A parallel from the acting industry or the other, you know, famous class of agents, most agents don't have Tom Cruise. You know, only one of them's got it. There's only a handful of, okay, a couple handfuls of A-list actors. But what about all the extra, you know, the, not the extras, but like the little bit parts, the person who comes in, says a few lines, goes off, someone's got to represent them, you know, and those actors, like working writers, you know, they work their butts off. They do little things that don't get much attention sometimes in the beginning, and they eventually build up the people, you know, the body of work, and people start to respect it and they get more and more. But those actors have agents, and they're not going to make anyone $1 million in a year, even themselves.
That's a good point and a good parallel. I can think of a lot of TV actors who've crossed over into being successful movie actors. Chris Pratt is a great example right now because he's everywhere in the movies. But he started out as some guy no one knew on a TV series that had a small cult following. So, again, that I would easily compare that to a mid-list author who no one really knew about, but over time, develop a breakaway hit and boom, you're out there and everybody wants you and you're suddenly the sexy writer of the year. So there's definitely a place for that, and the idea that no one's going to publish you unless you're able to produce a six-figure deal is bullshit. There's also the question, too, of whether or not the agent you're working with or the publishing house you're working with is new and hungry or well-established and already has a full roster. There are frequently agents who are just entering the agent profession. You can see them at conferences and places. They really want to go out and recruit authors who are going to make the money. And the new agents are always the hungriest. They're always going to find the authors they can take a chance on, because no well-established author is going to take a chance on an unknown agent. So it's sort of like the agent is taking a gamble on the author, but the author is also taking a gamble on the agent. And as a new author, finding new agents who are hungry can be a great way for you to find an agent and get into publishing if you really want to go the traditional publishing route.
Yeah, I was just listening to a podcast that was talking about the guy who was Lady Gaga's agent. And he was at the bottom. Like, he had nothing because some stuff had gone really wrong. He had they had mortgaged their house to, like, no, they had pawned their wedding rings to keep the house from getting foreclosed, like that level of broke. And he was so hungry, and he had a history of like being good, but because he was hungry and willing to do whatever it took to make her successful, he took on Lady Gaga, who was nothing at the time. No one had ever heard of her. She was just some young girl who had some talent and a piano. And he helped create her into Lady Gaga. And because he was so hungry, he did amazing things for her. And I think the same would apply to agents in any industry, including the literary industry. If, like, I was an agent and I found an author, like, this is just a fantastic book. Anyone who reads this is going to, like, be telling all their friends, yes, I will take that person on. And because I don't have anyone else, I'm going to work my ass off for them so that, like, they will be successful, and then I will be successful. Like, there's a lot of reasons to take on someone who is unknown, and it's not just hungry agents.
That's true. But the same also would go for a small or new publisher. So a small or new publisher will certainly take on authors who are unknown or who are not guaranteed to produce $100,000 in a deal. For the same reason, they need to grow their stable, they need to get their footing, practice what works. There's all this, the same sort of things that go into whether or not an agent would take a new writer. So if you are a new writer and you find that you're getting rejected by the well-known literary agents, try some younger ones, try some hungrier ones, try some small presses. There's certainly a lot of options before you go around saying, nope, no one's going to take me, I'm not going to sell $100,000. That's sort of spoken like someone who's a frustrated author.
They wouldn't take me, so obviously the cards are stacked.
Exactly. Oh, and by the way, this other guy who I mentioned who was talking about how literary work was better than other work admitted in the course of the comments that he had written a book and it had not been successful. So with that in mind, all of his comments come off as a bitter author who just couldn't make it in the industry. If you have time, go read the comments. They're kind of funny. So another thing that I came across in the comments, someone said, authors aren't allowed to complain about adaptations. And the next commenter said, and rightly so. I think it's pretty awful the way studios try to rip off authors, but if you sell your story, that kind of rids you of the right to complain about the adaptation. I guess she means adaptation. Everyone has seen terrible adaptations of books, so the author must know that there's a chance of the film or show being crap.
Doesn't mean you have to be happy about it.
That's true, but I was going to say this goes back to what I spoke about in the last podcast about rights. So as an author, when you sign a contract with a publisher, you are agreeing to give them certain rights to publish your book in whatever formats, and often that includes subsidiary rights, including TV and movie adaptations. So when you sign those rights over to the publisher, you sort of are losing the opportunity to say anything. And one thing you may be able to do is try to add clauses in to say, okay, I will give you the right to sell this stuff, but I have to approve the studio, or just terms that make it more palatable for you and give you some say in the process.
Those terms frequently also mean that the publisher is going to have a hell of a harder time selling it to anyone.
That's true. And if you're a new author, a publisher may not agree to those terms in your contract, as we had spoken about. Actually, you should go listen to that podcast if you are interested in this in more detail.
I speaking of not having a right to complain, I remember there was a Stephen King book about like a possessed truck or something like that. I don't remember what it was. I didn't read the book, but I saw the movie, or at least parts of it. And whoever directed this movie decided, yes, we're going to take a tractor trailer truck, and we're going to put a 6-foot-high green smiling Joker face thing on the grill of the truck. And this is our demonic truck. And it was the most ridiculous looking thing. And it's like, no. Whoever wrote that story, I don't care that it's Stephen King, like anyone who wrote the story has the right to be upset at that like horrendous mockery. Like, what are you I wrote a good story and you put a giant green plastic face on the grill to make it ominous. And it was just like, it was so stupid. And it's like, yes, Stephen King has every right to complain, as does everyone who had to see that movie.
That's a fair point. So there's a few pieces around this statement to unpack, and we just sort of touched on how much say do you have over the adaptation as an author. But there are also other things to think about, like how much say do you really want over the adaptation? For a lot of writers, maybe they don't actually care so much about how it's going to be represented in a film, especially if the thing that just got bought, the rights to it just got bought, is something you wrote like 10 books ago, and your headspace is in a completely different place right now, and you're working on 3 other projects. Do you really want to be wasting your brain power on how this movie or TV series comes out? Sometimes the answer is yes, absolutely. Sometimes the answer is no, not really. It's not worth it to me. I'm really thinking about this other thing that I'm doing right now.
Because basically, unless you're the screenwriter, stuff is going to get changed in a way that you don't agree with. Like, it's going to happen because whoever is the screenwriter is going to have a slightly different take on it because they're a different human being with a different brain that thinks different ways. So it's like, unless you can be the screenwriter yourself, and even then, like, the adaptations that have to be made for time, like most books, you want to tell that story in an hour and a half, you're going to have to start chopping.
Also, most authors are not also screenwriters. It's a different skill set, and just because you were able to write a book doesn't mean you'll write a good movie. Or TV script, or whatever the case is.
And vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, there's a question of whether the end result will be better suited to film and TV than the original story. There are cases, like Kay was saying, just by default, by virtue of books being packed with material, you're going to have to cut stuff. And the new story has to be suited to the medium where it's being presented. So there may be major plot beats that are left out for the sake of telling the story in a different medium, and that's okay. No one wants the story to be told in the same way as a book, or else they'd read the book. Well,
I disagree with that completely.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point.
There are many books which I would happily watch translated to a 10-hour movie. I would want intermission.
Yeah, to that point, Lord of the Rings, the fact that they made The Hobbit into a 3-book,
The wrong way.
That's going the wrong way, but still, keeping in all the original material and then adding some more material that didn't need to be there. Let's not get into that. So another thing that might be a factor as to how much say you want over the adaptation, maybe you're just happy to get the paycheck and you don't care about spending a lot of time and effort on it. for most authors, when the rights to a TV or film based on a book get exercised, it's so long past the time when they wrote that, they're working on other stuff, and they don't even care at that point. The idea that that is just going to earn them more money is like icing on top of a cake.
Well, that and most authors make so little that, like, hey, you're going to pay my rent?
Yeah.
Excellent.
That's true. But because these rights get exercised so long after books come out, in most cases, most authors have already earned through their residuals or anything they're going to earn through on their advance and are not really making much money from the story at that point. So the idea that they can suddenly auto-magically get more money without having to do any work, heck yeah. Why would you say no to that? Obviously, there are cases when you would do that. But, you know, some authors, that is the right call, and no one should judge them for it. There's also the fact that movie and TV adaptions, even if they don't resemble the book very much, can drive book sales. They drive sales of the title that is being adapted, and they can also drive other backlist titles. So while you as an author may not have earned a penny from that book in 3 years because it's been out forever, all of a sudden that book may become a bestseller because it's also a movie. So there's definitely more financial gain to be had than just a paycheck from someone exercising the residual rights. And there's also the sell-through to your other catalog, which the synergy from that is amazing. There's another author who is becoming popular right now. He wrote A Man Called Uv. I've listened to videos of people pronouncing this and I'm still getting it wrong. A Man Called Uv. The author is Frederick Bachman. And I have been watching in the past few months as a number of his other works have suddenly crept onto the bestseller list one by one. And a lot of these works were written years ago. So the fact that this one thing is becoming a bestseller and is getting a lot of attention now is drawing a lot of attention to this author in general. And he is probably enjoying a really successful time in his career right now as all these other books become bestsellers and are driving a lot of money to his publisher and therefore to him. So another comment about this article says, Mr. Lowney suggests self-published authors need an agent after a deal offer. They're self-published because they can't get an agent. The films listed veer to science fiction, and many agents state no sci-fi, short stories, or poetry in the writer's and artist's yearbook. However, as the function of an agent is to get a deal, why would a self-published author pay an agent who didn't get the deal a percentage, instead of paying a specialist media contract lawyer a fee? So there are a few misconceptions in this statement. One is that self-published authors are self-published because they can't get an agent. There are a number of cases where that is simply not true. People have chosen to self-publish for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it may be because they couldn't get an agent or a publisher, a traditional publisher, wasn't interested in their work right now. Again, if you go back and listen to the How Do Publishers Decide What Books to Buy podcast, you'll have a better idea of what goes into those buying decisions. But there are also cases where people have been traditionally published and then they decide to go off and self-publish because they want more of the income themselves, or traditional publishing takes a long time, or they don't have enough control over the end product when they're publishing traditionally. There are a bunch of reasons people might publish traditionally without an agent that have nothing to do with the quality of the work. So that in itself is misconception.
An interesting recent case is the author of The Martian. So he...
Andy Weir, by the way.
Andy Weir, yeah. He published The Martian as a kind of serial fiction on his blog. And then he went and made a book out of it and threw it up on Amazon. And he was starting to get some sales, but he wasn't really paying much attention to it. And then it started getting pretty popular. And a publisher approached him. And the publisher said, do you have an agent? And he said, no. And the publisher said, let me get you a contact. And the publisher got him an agent. So that, because the publisher was like, we know where this is going and we understand the value of an agent. So it's like he was self-published in the most self-publishy way you can, putting it on his blog. And then, I mean, he was just a space geek who liked writing. And then, like, he didn't get a publisher because he couldn't get one. He, you know, it's just like,
he didn't bother.
Right. He just didn't bother. And like, he didn't even care about his sales because he wasn't like, you know, it's like, I'm making some money, but whatever. Like, he just wasn't paying attention. And then it kind of shot up the charts. And eventually he started going, wait a minute, this is actually a fair bit of money every month. And yeah.
Andy, by the way, is mentioned in this article as well, because he's another self-published author who got bought up by Hollywood, and The Martian, as we all know, did very well in film.
It did very well in film, partially because it did so damn well in the books. They're like, this is actually going to work really well.
But again, that goes back to one of the things we were talking about earlier. Hollywood, like any other business, the investors want to make money. So if you can show there's a proven audience for this work, then they're more likely to be interested in it. It's less risky for them.
Yep.
So going back to this comment, in addition to the idea that they are self-published because they can't get an agent being crap, so there are two ways you could approach this type of thing. So this person says, why would you pay an agent a percentage instead of just hiring a lawyer directly and paying a fee? So those are the two ways. You can either get an agent who will take a percentage of the overall deal, or you can go out and hire a contract lawyer, or ideally a media contract lawyer specialist.
Still, it's such a ridiculously ignorant statement.
And pay a fee to them, which is going to be less than a percentage that you would pay an agent. So if you were to go the agent route, the agent would probably pay the lawyer's fee out of the agent cut, or they may pass it on to you as an expense. It depends on the agent. You'd have to look at your contract with the agent to find that out. Whereas if you go directly to a lawyer, you just pay the fee direct, which is probably going to be an hourly fee for the amount of time they spend on the contract, reviewing it, suggesting edits, going back and forth with the publishing, or the, in this case, Hollywood, so the media company, and then refining and whatever. In theory, the lawyer would cost you less, but also in theory, unless you, as a first-time self-published author being approached by Hollywood, are somehow automagically able to make the right contact with a specialist media attorney who knows how much author books sell for to Hollywood, that lawyer isn't going to be able to advise you on the business aspect of the deal, only on the legal aspect.
Well, and also the your agent is financially motivated to get you the best possible deal they can. The lawyer gets paid hourly. Like, he doesn't care. The agent is going to work. Like, if they go, oh, there might be a movie thing in here, I'm going to do everything I can to get you the most money, the most royalties, to get you the best deal. Like, you know, maybe I get you part of the merchandising. You know, lawyer may be aware of aspects like this, but they're not going to be nearly as savvy as an agent who works in this area and knows what to talk about, what to focus on, and how to deal with contract or with the negotiations that aren't just about the fine nitty gritty of the contract.
More importantly, though, an agent is in the field every day, living with these deals and breathing these deals. A contract lawyer is reviewing contracts every day. So a contract lawyer is going to be looking at, you know, whether this clause complies with the state law and the state that is issuing the contract and the author's state, whereas a agent is going to know, oh, well, Patrick Rothfuss just got this much money for the TV adaptation version of Wise Man's Fear, so we should probably be looking for something a little less than that because you're not Patrick Rothfuss. Or, well, Andy Weir got this much money for The Martian, and it was a self-published book, and this is sort of what you can expect because your book has roughly the same sales as Andy Weir's book before the media company picked it up, so we should be asking for this much. So the idea that an agent isn't doing anything for you because you already have the deal is sort of a misconception.
Yeah. The lawyer will make sure that the media companies don't have a loophole to not pay you at all. The agent will make sure they pay you as much as possible.
So related to that, another person commented, quoting the article, as long as self-published authors take on an agent, they should be fine. So this is something that someone said in the article. This commenter says, that's a laugh. It's the agents who decide whether or not to take on a self-published author, and basically, they don't. We are still reviled as vanity authors and have little to no standing in literature. So this commenter is a little bit right and a little bit not right. It is true that as an author, you are soliciting an agent, and an agent has to decide whether or not they want to work with you as an author. It is also true that being a self-published author has absolutely no standing in the eyes of an agent because anybody can self-publish. It doesn't, however, mean that if you are a self-published author who is doing well, an agent won't want to represent you. That is backwards. The idea that if you're a self-published author and you can point to book sales, say, I sell this many books every month, I do this much promotion, and really give your data over to an agent, that's going to make an agent want you more than some random person who's never been published at all. Because the random person who's never been published at all has no data to back up what they're saying. Whereas you as a self-published author, assuming that you're doing your job and marketing and a successful self-published author, that's going to give you way more standing in the eyes of an agent and make you much more desirable.
Right. And successful doesn't have to be, like, bestseller. Successful just has to be like, hey, show that you're making money worthy of spending effort to, worthy of the agent's effort.
And it's not just about the amount of money you're making. It's also about what you're doing to market, because an agent may see, okay, this person is doing X, Y, and Z to market. So if we add in A, B, and C, we're going to dramatically propel their sales. Like, if an agent can see a clear way to contribute to your career in a way that's going to make them money, the agent's going to take you on. So there's this idea that self-publishing is vanity publishing and, you know, we're not getting respect as self-publishers, whatever. That's sort of true and sort of not true for a variety of reasons, which we've spoken about here and in other podcasts as well. So one thing that kept cropping up over and over again throughout all the comments is the idea that self-published equals poor quality, or it's unoriginal, or it's writing to a formula. And as someone who may be considering self-publishing, you ought to be aware that this is an attitude that exists and you're going to encounter these people. It's changing. The self-publishing industry is proving itself to be more successful. And personally, I'm seeing a lot of things that are being done in self-publishing and small indie publishing that is really going to be in the long term more successful than traditional publishers, because self-publishers and small indies are doing a lot more to deliver value to the readers and are really pivoting and taking advantage of new media and online resources in ways that traditional publishers haven't figured out yet.
Right. They don't have money to spend on massive advertising campaigns, so instead they have to get creative. And oh, look, it works, and it has done in every industry ever.
And it's been interesting. One thing that I've been doing lately for the business side of Bright Little Light Press, I've been sort of comparing some of the self-published author success with some traditional publishing authors and what their strategies are on each side of the fence. And I'm seeing the self-publishers, what they're doing is way more appealing to readers than what traditional publishers are doing. So one example of this is in newsletters. A traditional publisher, one of the big five, had this really shitty landing page for signing up for newsletters. And they were giving away hardly any incentive to readers to give them their email address. I think traditional publishers are not understanding how resistant people are becoming to giving up their email addresses, because we don't want to get all this spam and crap in our inboxes. So we want a good reason to give you our email address. And people are more willing to do it to an author whose work they like, or who's going to give them, like, I'll give you a free book, something really worthwhile. Whereas this particular publisher's landing page that I was looking at was like, yeah, we'll take your email address and we're going to share it with all of our subsidiary companies and all of our partners. So you know you're going to get like 10 emails from different people
about random crap
that has nothing to do with the book that you want to hear about. And the book that you want to hear about isn't even on offer. They're just going to send you, like, author information, which you can get anywhere. So
most people don't want to follow a publisher. They want to follow an author.
Exactly. So publishers just aren't getting some things that self-publishers and indie authors are really getting the hang of now. And I think that's going to continue to change the landscape of publishing. So while you will still encounter this attitude that small publishers and self-publishers are inferior, poor quality, whatever, the industry is changing. A few years ago, you wouldn't be able to self-publish. The idea that a self-publisher could have any sort of commercial success was sort of laughable. And now the industry is being crowded with a glut of poor quality self-publishing, which is part of why people are making these sort of assumptions. yeah, there's a lot of bad stuff out there that people never would have been able to publish before self-publishing became a possibility. But there's also a lot of good stuff, too.
Hmm, that sounds like something familiar. Maybe the internet? I think that might have been successful.
And one thing to think about is authors who are unsuccessful or who produce poor quality work are going to be found out rather quickly and are never going to be successful. So they may produce a few books and then decide, okay, I'm wasting way too much time and not making any money, and wander off and do something else. So for readers, they can look at an author's works and see, oh, well, this person has actually published 10 books and they have decent reviews. So I don't care if they're self-published. People are enjoying their stuff and I'm going to go read it. And there's sort of a general saying in the indie industry that the cream will rise to the top. And I hate it. It's a stupid cliche, but it's also true. People who are working hard at their self-publishing or small indie publishing careers are going to be successful if they continue working at it and use these methods that are proven.
Exactly the same with so many websites out there. People keep publishing good stuff. You know, I'm thinking of a lot of like geeky tech news sites. You know, some of them have risen to the top and become extremely good, like The Verge and
Ars Technica.
Like, oh, look, people keep producing quality content and they get a reputation for quality content and it spirals up and, you know, they get more and more readers, they get more advertisers, et cetera, et cetera. And meanwhile, the internet is filled with, like, orders of magnitude more people putting out absolute crap on their blogs. So it's like, it doesn't matter that there's crap out there. The good stuff will rise up.
That is, however, not to say that that will happen without work on your part.
Oh, hell no.
It requires a lot of work on your part.
Oh, yeah.
And one commenter said something that I think is worth pointing out, which is, not every indie author is going to be a Mark Dawson or an Andy Weir. Some people just maybe aren't going to be very good storytellers or not very good writers, and ultimately maybe aren't cut out for this career. That's true. I'm sorry to say, some people are just not going to work out in writing. If you're someone who is determined to do this and spend the time to work at it and is going to continue to improve and, you know, work hard, then you will eventually find your way to some semblance of success.
Yeah, I think that applies to almost every profession. Like, you may not be naturally gifted at it, but if you keep working at it, you're going to be reasonably passable eventually, you know? Hopefully you will be better than reasonably passable, but, like, anything, you work at it hard enough, you keep practicing, like, you're going to be good enough as anyone else in that profession, you know, on average.
It's sort of like talking about art versus craft. There are some artists who are inherently talented and who are able to push the envelope and create these things that nobody else has ever conceived. There are some writers who are going to do that too. But most are actually more like craftsmen. It's something that they work at over time, they polish their skills, and they can make a passable living doing it. So maybe you're someone who does portraits that are commissioned. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with not being Picasso. If you're out there doing something you enjoy doing and you're able to make money on it, that's a win. So that was some of the comments on this thread. And again, I will put a link to the original Guardian article in the show notes. Basically, I just wanted to clear up some common misconceptions and things that you may run into if you decide to self-publish, or if you're thinking about working with a small indie publisher. You should know that these attitudes are out there in the world. People are going to say these things, and you need to decide that it's not going to bother you, or decide that it does bother you and try to pursue a traditional publishing deal where you may not be commercially successful, or you will be slower to roll out, or a variety of things that may not get you the net result you want.
Which also all apply to self-publishing.
This is true. If you have questions about this, go back and listen to the other podcasts. This is sort of an ongoing thing. But yeah, hopefully you found this at least somewhat informative and not just griping. And as always, thank you for bearing with us, listeners. Again, apologies for my congested state and the sniffling and coughing. I will hopefully attempt to edit it all out during editing. And we will talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.